Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck Knicks? What the fuck Tuckians? What's happening? How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. Whew, take a deep breath. I hope everybody's hanging in, staying frosty, keeping alert, taking care of themselves, not falling in, trying to get up out of bed. Have a life, enjoy things, maybe a chocolate bar, pet a dog, have fun with your kids. That's the thing with me. How's everybody doing? All right. Sorry. I got right off into it. What's happening? Everybody all right? My chest has been tight and, I'm back. I'm back from vacation, from my relatively successful vacation where I was in a beautiful place. And about half the time, I was actually in the beautiful place. The other half that time, I was in my head in a very, very ugly place. But it's good to be back. It's good to be back at my house. It's good to be back at the garage. It's good to see my cats. Everybody is okay. Monkey, fine. LaFonda, good. Buster Kitten is now sort of evolving into a fairly sensitive and unpredictable. I don't know what age would be comparable to a human, but he's no longer just crazy. He seems to be evolving a personality and requires affection occasionally. And he likes to eat things out of my bowl. Deaf Black Cat, the warrior spirit animal, is under the house and doing well. And occasionally Scaredy number two shows up out front. Big head from down the street pees on the door. So I came home to that. And there are coyotes around. That's always a scary reality. And you can see it as a metaphor as well. When you see, when you're driving in your car and you see that lone coyote, or maybe two or three of them, and they stop and they look at you, and you know that they're not necessarily going to attack you because that's not a coyote's way. Maybe they're presenting you with an issue of some kind. But usually what they do is they scurry off into the dark and attack something smaller than them. Yes, metaphors abound, but there are some coyotes around. Hey, so Ryan Adams is on the show today. And it's interesting, the Ryan Adams and Ryan Adams music, is that there's a few Ryan Adams records that I really liked. And I listened to a lot, but I never have gotten into the full catalog with full-on intensity. The nerd tensity that many people have with Ryan, people who love Ryan. But I know I always knew he was an interesting guy, and we talked for a nice long time, got to know each other. So getting back to the comedy stage, I got on stage last night over the weekend. Been the first sets I'd done in 3 weeks. I brought everything that was in my heart and in my mind. A little bit of anger, a little bit of anxiety. But ultimately, afterwards, there was a tremendous catharsis with people, and they came up to me and were very appreciative. We got to keep talking, man. God damn it. We just got to keep talking to each other. I got a couple emails. Why not read a couple emails before I bring Ryan on? Listening with my son. Hey, Mark, I've been a fan for a few years now. Listening to the conversations you have with people has been a large part of my continued hope and faith in creativity, art, and people. Thank you for that. Recently, I started listening to certain episodes with my son. He is 10, which may seem a little young to be listening, but I have been surprised at what he has picked up on and been interested in. He thought your bit about the fuck it cookies was hilarious. Well, that's actually written for a 10-year-old. And that sparked a really interesting conversation about body insecurity and eating your feelings. We've talked about politics, art, religion, work ethic, and comedy, of course. When we started listening, always in the car and just the two of us, I told him, when it's just you and me, just us, you can talk to me about whatever the fuck you want. The truth is, I know in 4 or 5 years, he probably won't want to spend much time with me, but my hope is we will have the car and WTF to talk about whatever. My hope is to keep a line of communication open in a space where I'm not just his old man. Thanks for what you do and the beautiful place your conversations hold in my life already and hopefully hold in the future. Sean. Thank you, Sean. Sometimes I don't know if what I'm doing is, standing up to the test of our situations in life at this juncture in history. I'm happy to hear it. And this is another email that is, it's heavy, but it's still along the lines of what we're talking about, Opposites attract. Hey, Mark, let me introduce myself. I'm Rita from Texas and a big fan. The truth is, you and I could not be more different. I am a mother of 3 crazy boys and married to the handsome guy I've loved since 11th grade. I've never done a single drug and only started drinking, but really not much, when I had children. I'm a medical provider and spend most of my days keeping my kids and patients alive, which can be challenging at times. I don't swear too much, and I really am not a cat fan, mostly due to allergies, but alas, it is true. Sorry, Boomer. In November, most of us felt deep sadness and fear when the election did not go as we had hoped. The sobering part is that I currently live 15 minutes from Mexico in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. Every day I encounter those considered undesirable or bad. Every day I find love, grace, and kindness in a people soon to be ostracized and likely removed from our lovely area. Every day I hear stories of heartache and struggle. Every day I see faces of those unappreciated. However, your podcast gives me hope that somehow I can make a difference. The lessons I learn from those you interview are invaluable. Your interviews, your engagement, your curiosity, and your graciousness with each guest inspires me to find those things in the people I meet. So thank you. I've been trying to do more kind things and share gratitude with others since the election. Thus, the inspiration for this letter. I hope it finds you well and rested from your vacation. Keep it up. Thanks again, Rita. Thank you, Rita. I will keep it up. I will. So, me and Ryan Adams. I liked Ryan Adams. We had common friends. I knew who he was. There was a couple of his records I listened to a lot. And then I realized there are people that love him more deeply than anything in the world. And that he's got a very powerful following. And people just crave everything Ryan Adams does. All 900 of his records. He also brought me back in touch with Mark Spitz, the writer who I was friends with, who passed away a week or so ago. Just before he passed away, I was texting with him about Ryan because he had written a piece on Ryan. And that was one of the sad sort of good things. I'm glad I had those few interactions with Mark, who was feeling pretty good. So I really don't know what happened. I have not heard yet. But the thing that put me over the top in terms of interviewing Ryan was I saw some little bit of footage of him playing an acoustic guitar at not even a music event, really. It looked like some other kind of event where someone handed him a guitar and he did a cover, an acoustic cover of my favorite Grateful Dead song. There's a few songs by the Grateful Dead that really moved me deeply, and he seemed to be very moved deeply by the song that he was playing that had a very big impact on my life. I'm like, that guy clearly loves that song, and I love that song, so I'm going to talk to that guy. And I'll talk to him about that. You'll hear it in a second. So Ryan Adams, let's do it, huh? Don't you think? His 16th album, Ryan Adams' 16th full-length solo album, Prisoner, comes out this Friday, February 17th. He's got a bunch of U.S. tour dates throughout the winter and spring. Go to paxamrecords.com for dates and cities. This is me talking to Ryan Adams. You opened for the Stones?
I did, actually, yeah.
And did you have any time with them?
I did, in fact.
Yeah?
But I had been around them before.
Yeah, when?
So, first time being around them,
yeah.
The first time that would make sense for me to say, like, oh, yeah, I was hanging out with them or close to them was when I was in the mix process
yeah.
of Whiskey Town Strangers Almanac.
So the first band.
Yeah, so in the building, this is strange to say, but Don Was is across the hall from me mixing.
The producer and bass player, Don Was.
Yes.
Yeah, the guy.
The Wizard of Was, the Was Man.
Yeah.
And
so he's across the hall.
Yeah, and I actually, I had met him, but we weren't the bros we are now.
Yeah.
Because it's, he's my friend now. Yeah. Like, he's the guy I call, first guy I call to play bass.
Yeah.
First guy I call if I need advice. He's just always there. Great guy. But at the time, I was actually freaking out because I loved Was Not Was, and I loved the way that he ran that band. And yeah. I loved how subtly, so out of control those records were.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people might not realize, like, you know, Walk the Dinosaur is about nuclear war.
Right.
Like,
yeah, that's buried in there. How do you know that?
Well, I knew before, yeah. But strangely, in a conversation with him, he was like, you're one of the few people that understood that. And I was like, yeah, the chorus is basically meant you're doing a dance out of when they would tell school children of my generation to get on the floor and get under your desk if a bomb went off, in case of a nuclear war.
Yeah.
Which, like, really would not probably help you in many ways.
Sure.
But, so, that's kind of how that song... I mean, I sort of saw the subtleties in that. And,
yeah.
And they were incredible live and on TV when you'd see them at work. But, so, he's across the hall. Keith and Charlie and Mick. Everyone's in there. I think Bill had left by then. And then, down the hall is Ethan Johns with Chris Stills. Ethan, who would later do my first solo record.
Right.
Weirdly. And then
Gwen's kid.
Yeah. And then all the way down the hall on the other side was Scott Litt working on a Liz Phair album. So what's weird is like all these people would later come together. Like two or three days ago, like Don Was is playing bass at my studio. Liz Phair is on guitar. My friend Nate is on drums.
2 days ago.
A couple days ago. Yeah. We've been working on her thing. So that's how I originally met Stones. And they were lovely. I got into a conversation with Charlie Watts first about Penny Loafers. And I just said, you know, I walked in and I saw him and I was just like, oh, okay. And I was like, okay, just be, I told myself, just be cool. It's fine. Which it was.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, you know, how's it going? How's your day? And he's like, you know, it's the usual waiting around. And then he's like, I went to buy a pair of Penny Loafers. He's like, it's the damnedest thing. He's like, I collect Penny Loafers. I quite like them. And then he puts his foot up on this roll case. And he said, do you want to see the strangest thing? He's like, do you have a penny or a dime? And I said, yeah, totally. And I was like, that's probably all I have. And I pulled it out. And he goes, he's like, penny won't actually fit in them. And he's like, and I don't understand. He's like, if I were to pull the stitch out, I feel like it would be wrong. Like, how do I know where it ends? Like, he was getting deep about it.
About the penny, about getting the penny in.
Yeah, and I just remember going like, man, I'm like talking to Charlie Watts about like penny loafers right now. This is very unusual. And we had the funniest conversation, and he was super cool. Keith was always very nice.
Yeah.
I would run into him, and I drank a lot in those days. I mean, not in the day, but at nighttime, we were mixing, I get bored. And strangely, at that time, I drank Southern Comfort, which is not for the weak of spirit.
It's also easy going down, though. As far as the hard stuff goes, that was a popular one when I was in high school because you could get it down. We used to do flaming shots in high school. We fill the cap up, set it on fire.
It feels like after a while, like your mouth and throat have been like coated with like a bubble gum residue.
Yeah, like a syrup.
You wake up and like you can't move your lips. You're like, what is happening?
It never happened. Southern Comfort never happened again after high school for me.
Yeah, it was pretty gross. But I guess I don't know, for some reason it was the thing I thought I could handle.
Did you grow up with it?
No. I mean, I grew up around people drinking and stuff. I mean, at different intervals. And it was something I found later.
Yeah.
Socially awkward, therefore, you know, just drink and kind of took the edge off.
Yeah.
And I would see Keith, like, we'd either be, because you could smoke in studios back then. Or go into the upstairs restroom and I'd run into him on the way down or way up. And he's like, it's like rush hour in here, kid. That's the first thing he ever said to me. And I think I was just like, honk, honk. I just said something funny back. I just was disarmed.
Yeah. I smoked my first cigarette in 10 years with him.
Wow.
I made a decision. It was good.
I understand that decision, strangely. I really do. I think I understand it. And I mean...
I had to. He's my fucking hero.
He's really cool. I had really good conversations and times with him on that tour.
He likes to laugh. He likes to spin the yarn.
He's very funny.
Very funny.
And he's also very... for any caricature that anyone thinks about this man, he is a deeply intellectual guy.
Well, that was what everyone learned when that book came out. People who hadn't talked to him, because having, you know, worshipped him for my whole life, he kind of got him in a box.
Yeah,
as this junky dude who represents this lifestyle. But then you read that book, you're like, holy fuck!
Yeah,
he knows everything.
Yeah, I remember the first time I was having a conversation with him, and he passed me a joint, and I remember my brain went into that freeze moment where you're like, you know, maybe it's like, imagine someone who their whole life they loved Meryl Streep or something.
Yeah,
they have pictures of her on their wall, right, or whatever, and so they find themselves at a coffee shop and they're behind her, and then they say something, and that time starts to slow down and freeze just for the moment where their pleasant exchange happens.
Yeah,
I mean, unless it's like probably some asshole.
Yeah,
like,
right.
But I remember. They were like, it was before I went on, it was the day, and it was a big production. He was like, Keith says, come down to Camp X-Ray. That was the name of his backstage area,
yeah,
which is awesome.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, right on. And I went down and said hello. I sat down, and I remember he passed me this joint.
Yeah.
And time just went, and I looked at his fingers, and I looked at my fingers going to grab it, and it was like, in my mind, I was imagining like the Sistine Chapel or whatever.
Yeah,
where it's like
the two hands, hand of God and the hand of man.
Yeah, it's like I was like, oh my God, the joint is being passed. It was so crazy. That was like one of the better ones. But yeah, I didn't want to open for them because I knew that I knew enough to know that, like, for me, you know, I would do it for everyone else in the band to have the experience.
Right.
But I knew that no one was going to care.
Right. Because you were the opening band.
Yeah. And what's interesting was it was the first time I ever probably really went, I know they don't care. So therefore, I actually will try this new thing called, I'm going to try so friggin' hard to see what I could do.
To get them to care?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, or to at least... Because at the time, what kind of a brat kid I was or whatever I was thinking, I was like, well, this means I could do anything I want and I don't want to phone it in.
In an arena of 20,000 people?
Yeah, some of those shows were really, really big.
And did you get them to care?
I think a few times.
Yeah.
I mean, I did.
What'd you do, though? What do you do? Do you push harder? Do you go deeper? What decisions are you making with your guitar and your mouth up there that's going to connect with an incoming crowd for a Rolling Stones show?
I mean, I don't know. I don't remember each one.
Was it a song choice or was it an intensity choice?
Well, the song choice was really stupid. Instead of playing songs that would have been recognizable to the audience in any way, because I believe that this tour would have been at the very end of the gold kind of tour time.
And that was your big record.
I mean, people say that, but I don't remember it that way at all.
Yeah.
There was really, at the time, like, there was no love. Like,
yeah.
Like, it was not the thing it is, but then it becomes the thing over time.
Maybe, in retrospect.
I guess it...
You get your place. You know, as history goes, like, as the history is written, that takes a place in relative to the rest of your career. Like, oh, what about Whiskey Town?
It's made me question and be a different person specifically, only in seeing the way that the past, whether it be a negative or a positive thing to the person, how it then can translate later as completely false, and yet to that person or to the common knowledge of humans, a complete inaccuracy.
Right.
And there's no way to shift it.
But also,
it's very interesting.
With music, it's very personal. Like, you know, whatever you may think or whatever the reality of it is, you know, how people look at that stuff in relation to the rest of your work, you know, you can't take that away from them.
No, totally. But I mean, actual stories or specific things where you go like...
Mythology.
Yeah, you go like, well, that, I know that didn't happen, but I guess I'm going to let that ride. But it makes you think about I don't take it personally. I think about it in terms of world history. I'm like, oh, cool. So like, wait, like, so what stuff really happened or didn't happen?
Right.
Like, it makes you question like the way that things are handed down. I think the day that you process that information and take it into your heart or like really can know that that is true.
Yeah.
That is a day of change.
Yeah.
For any human.
Yeah.
And maybe it doesn't happen for some, but for those that it happens to, I think that it's from that fork in the road that only a little bit further down the road, once you've seen that, you have two more forks, and one of them is towards bitterness and the other is towards total acceptance that you're not really in control of the way information is, and so you just ride with it.
Well, that fork between bitterness and acceptance is it can come at several junctures. You know what?
Yeah, it keeps forking off.
It does, yeah. Right? There, you always come to that fork, and yeah. I guess it gets a little easier to not choose bitterness as the complete road you're on if you have some success under your belt or you feel a little bit better about yourself, but. There's always, there's always the bitter rest stop.
Yeah.
you don't have to get on that road, but, you know, you might as well, you can pull over.
As a touring musician, I could attest that most of them are. For real. It's always a new experience. There's always a new insulting hat or someone's looking at you, you know, and you're in like your Black Sabbath, like long sleeve, cool bootleg t-shirt,
yeah,
and bunny slippers, and there's some truck driver that's just like, what the hell, son?
Where are you from?
Yeah, what is this clown show? You know, it's like, great. You're like, man, it's the middle of the night. I'm stoned. I'm just trying to find the bathroom. Like, great.
Give me a break.
Yeah, totally.
Well, it's weird because with my relationship with your music and what I've heard about you, like, I remember my first, like, I had, what do you think of the record Easy Tiger?
I mean, I really...
Because I listened to the shit out of that record. Mm. And for some reason, that was my introduction to you. I don't know why. I don't know where I got it or who told me to listen to it. But that was the one, at that point, where I played it a lot. And I was like, this is a great record.
I have a manager that is really... He is very smart.
Yeah.
And... For my creative world, the way that I am creative and the way that I can sort of do my music and make so much of it and do whatever, it's a difficult thing for anyone to edit that, producer or not.
Yeah.
Because the amount of information that's happening is a lot, and it's hard to know, like, if you're like a tennis player, but your hobby is tennis.
Yeah.
It's hard to know when is the real game happening. Some people
usually there's a crowd there and some trophy at stake.
Yeah. And I had Easy Tiger strangely would have been I mean, I really am very sentimental about that record, and so many tracks happen around that record, so it was a strange thing to have experienced to me making that record. But really, that record is like, I feel like it's the culmination of like 5 days or something out of about a 9 month to a year and a month recording session.
Oh, really?
Where I made so much other stuff because I had quit drinking and doing drugs around that time. And I didn't feel like going to like a rehab facility.
Yeah.
I later would learn a lot in therapy about things and why and all this different stuff and how it works. And
related to what, addiction?
I suppose so, yeah. I mean, I don't, although I completely and totally would choose to drink and smoke cigarettes and like do some drugs, it was usually in the application of doing music for a longer period of time.
You felt like it was a tool?
Yes, exactly. It was.
Yeah.
Very rarely was it a social thing. It was enriched for me, I think, by that feeling spaced out or whatever. But it all stopped around that time. And
Easy Tiger?
Yeah, before it.
Yeah.
So the way I did it was I just went in the studio for a year, basically. I just went every day, and I made whatever was on the top of my head, and the outcome of that was I was completely hyperactive and spastic, and I had no idea because I wasn't hungover and I wasn't like you know, feeling worn out from having been up till 7 a.m. or whatever it was. Yeah. I just was a different energy.
Yeah.
Which sort of turned into like, oh my God. And I had all this stuff to say and I said it all. And what's really weird is at the very end of it, like, I think a couple of maybe elegant things came out because I was completely exhausted of making like fake soundtracks for something that didn't exist and like bad, like hip hop stuff that I didn't know what I was doing or metal or who knows what I was doing in there.
So, well, I mean, but there, but that's sort of like part of your whole, the mystery of you is that, you know, you sort of move through all these different forms of music. And that, you know, you seem to have this never-ending recesses in your soul to express yourself through, you know, whatever you impulsively feel musically.
Which I think is how it should be.
Yeah.
You know, it's not for me to know how to create that thing where you want someone to want the next thing. To you want to create, like, not supply and demand, but you want things to be spaced out in a way where people have time to digest the information and you have a time to like express it on a tour and then maybe there's a lull and then you give people a new chapter. For me, it was like, I just lived music. It's just what, it was a safe place for me to go and it was where I wanted to be.
When did that start?
Ever since I got a guitar, 16, 15 years old. I always just played.
Where'd you come from?
Jacksonville, North Carolina.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there really wasn't, I mean, most of my friends were either like dying or getting arrested.
For what? And from what? Just this or that?
Drugs, skateboarding, but then getting wasted.
Yeah.
You know, wrecking their car. Who fucking knows?
Who'd you grow up with? Like what was the family situation?
I grew up with my brother and sister and my mom, but then kind of spent most of my time with my grandparents as much as I could until eventually I basically was sort of inseparable from them. It just was the right vibe for me.
What, why, what was going on with your mom?
I mean, it wasn't so much her as it was, you know, this is the part that's interesting. I feel there are some days now that my grandmother's passed, my G-ma and my papaw, as I would call them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, for at this chapter of my life anyway, and who knows by the end what I'll say, but I could almost say that one of the things I think I was here this time for, if there are many times,
yeah,
or even if it's just once, it was to be with them. It was to hang out with them.
With your grandparents?
Yeah, I knew them.
Yeah.
We were so funny. And my grandfather, he was so funny and like, he was like a prankster, you
yeah.
know, he's the kind of guy that like, you know, re-gifts you the same thing three times and you can't figure out how it's because he's stolen the thing back and put it back in the wrapper and like,
yeah, yeah.
like, you know, and like hide behind doors and like, you know, and he's always up for a journey. And then he got sick with emphysema and they approximated that he maybe would have like 7 months to a year to live. And he lived about seven years and a half, maybe a little more.
After he got diagnosed?
Yeah, because he was like, I feel like his position, and I'm certain he said it at least once, was he's like, I'm not going anywhere until the Braves win the World Series.
Yeah.
I remember literally looking at him and going like, you're going to live forever because it doesn't look good right now. And like, and you know, yeah, we would have that conversation.
Yeah,
and you'd
yeah.
crack up. And then like, I loved listening to his stories. He was in World War II and he saw a lot of his friends, people he was really close with, die.
Yeah.
And he was letting a lot of stuff go in those last years. And I was there for it. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I should have been like going like out to go like, what, like, where are the girls? Like, where's a boob? Like, should have been going to do what the mischievous young man does.
Like, you were like 15?
I mean, well, he got sick when I was 9, 10, something like that.
And where's your, and your mom lives close by?
Yeah, a couple of streets down.
Oh, okay.
So it was just easy to kind of stay with them. And also she had her hands full and like we didn't particularly get along.
No?
No.
And you have a brother and a sister?
Yeah, older brother, younger sister.
So the older brother element, what did he, how'd he end up?
He's a very math-minded person, which
oh, yeah.
is interesting because I can't do math, but I could write structured songs and all this
yeah,
stuff,
yeah.
but he could do complex math equations just in his head.
Yeah.
he's pretty interesting. But he grew up loving the Scorpions and Ozzy, and I thank him for that because he made sure that I had a copy of Diary of a Madman. Yeah, so yeah. I was like, cool, thank you. Thanks for that, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And my sister is really smart, and she, I think, the way that my brother was kind of like, I would say authentic nerd, and the way I was sort of skate punk nerd, maybe like nerd in awkwardness or whatever, or just in what I, you know, I was like reading Reader's Digest and watching like Doctor Who, the Fourth Doctor, and Dark Shadows. Like that's who I was from as far as I can remember. And that's because we had the University of North Carolina in Wilmington that was near enough that PBS was awesome.
Yeah.
Whoever was programming it was like a huge stoner because it was the weirdest stuff I ever seen. And so I was like into that. And my sister was maybe the more, I think in a good way, the most well-adjusted and interested in the contemporary life of high school and life.
And you and your brother were sort of off the grid a little.
Yeah, like, I mean, I think I had that, I think it was probably, looking back, I can imagine them thinking, like, wow, I was always, like, drawing or writing poetry or reading stuff or, like, asking these deep questions or spending time with Papal, who told me lots of really detailed, incredible stories, and my grandmother, there will never be someone like that. Like, she was an unbelievable person. You could not get her down.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she just crocheted blankets and watched TV and like, which is unbelievable. And she made lemon pound cake.
Yeah.
And she would, like, even though they lived right at the limit of just, I mean, I used to think that house was so nice and big and like, and she had like a big old black Comet car, you know. But I used to think that they had so much stuff. But when I actually went back after she passed, I was like, wow, this was a really minimal environment. But she was always crocheting blankets and making cakes. And then we would get in the car and she'd either drop them off at her church for the registry of people in need, or she would somehow find people who were like really needed a hand.
Or a cake.
Well, she would go grocery shopping and get canned goods and then either bring them a cake or a blanket.
Yeah.
And I would see that in real time. I'd be in the car. I would always go with her on the adventures.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, what has just happened? And she's like, well, I just picked up some stuff for our friends. And I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, well, who are they? She goes, oh, I don't know. And then she would turn on the radio and then we would both like listen to some cool classic song. And then if we're at a stoplight, she used to go along with the drums, like whatever song it was, she would make that noise.
Yeah.
That's my vivid memory of just not just music, but like how all that time was.
Yeah. And what was your mom doing?
I don't know. I don't know.
And where was your dad?
My dad was building houses.
Yeah.
He's a general contractor and he does a lot of like really cool cabinetry stuff. And
still?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. He's an interesting guy.
You have a relationship with him?
I do now. Yeah. And I did somewhat at the time.
Yeah.
My immediate parental history is somewhat strange in that it was kind of estranged.
Yeah.
Kind of. It just didn't really work for me. And it's like, it's so funny too, because it's like, I sometimes feel like it's sort of like Beetlejuice. It's like, I don't want to say it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even like to, it's like, I'll let it pass my mind once, then I'll be like, eh.
Yeah. What, the fact that it was estranged?
Just in general.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know.
Yeah. So when did you get the first guitar? 16?
Yeah, I traded my skateboard for a guitar.
Were you like a wild skateboarder, like pools and shit?
Yeah, that was mostly what I could do. It was in the beginning of when like Santa Monica Airlines and like Santa Cruz, those companies and those skaters started to, you know, the nose of the skateboard got a little bigger. And I would see my friends. At first, we were carving grinds, big ollies, going fast, going to pools that were drained and skating them bowls.
Yeah.
And just as I was getting out of it is when kick flips and like shove-its and all that stuff started happening.
Yeah.
Which is fine. But I remember thinking like, wow, I'm like watching my friend. He's like spending 4 hours like trying to land this double kickflip over this little hump at like the bank when it was closed. And I was just like, I just really want to go fast and like catch like some, like, you know, do like a big ollie and do some gnarly grab and get out of it before I'm like shredded on the pavement.
Right.
And or just grind stuff. And it was just how I was.
Yeah.
And it was at that point I was like, well, like maybe I'm more about ramp skating, but I didn't have a car and there wasn't really a pool to skate except for from this sort of semi-abandoned hotel at the edge of our neighborhood, which I still would skate.
Yeah.
And it was almost unskatable, but man, I made it skatable. I would just loosen the trucks up enough and just, I made it work. And if there was water in the bottom of the thing, like I didn't care. I was just like, I'm going to deal with it. This, see, I should have known something was weird.
Yeah.
Early on. And then, but it made sense. But I used to get like dizzy spells, but I also would get really discombobulated if I tried to skate backwards.
Yeah.
Because you see a lot of skaters, like they go up and they'll go up to the lip of a skateboard.
Yeah.
And then they put the skateboard over the top.
Yeah.
And they keep it there for a second.
Yeah.
And then they go backwards.
Yeah.
And then they roll down the transition backwards just by looking the other way and then do a trick from backwards to spinning around.
Right.
The only couple of times I tried to do that were brutal. They were like, I mean, that was like some stuff where you, I just was like, where am I? And then I just like slam as hard as I could. And I'm like, was that a moment? And then I like try like kind of a smaller version of that. And I'm like, oh, wow. Okay, cool. So I cannot fakie anything. Cannot go backwards.
Right.
Which is really interesting.
Was that the end of the skating career, that realization?
No, I mean, I still skate when I'm on tour. I skate around the venues. I enjoy it. And if I can find a park where I could really carve it up, it's great. And
so what was the music going on? I mean, what was it like, you know, outside of your brother's records, how do you get, you know, into the music?
Well, the first thing I ever did was I got the guitar. I really picked up, I think it was Half Hollow or something where I was like, there might be a picture. I know there's a picture of Andy Rourke playing his bass. And then there's a picture maybe of Johnny in the corner with a guitar. But for certain, there was a Black Sabbath record or two, maybe Dio era Sabbath.
Yeah.
Where you could see Tony Iommi playing.
Right.
And because I went to play the guitar and it didn't feel right. And I was like, I'm not making the sound. So I was like, what is happening? And I looked at the pictures and I was like, because I was like, the guitar must be broken. And then I looked at the pictures, I was like, wait, they're really pressed. He's really pressing down.
Yeah.
I was like, that has to be what these silver things are.
Right.
And I really pressed down and I hit the note and I'm like, oh. And then I was like, well, it doesn't sound right the way it's tuned. It was probably tuned normal.
Right.
And I was like, so that must be wrong because this doesn't sound like anything on there. So I detuned the E string. And then I detuned the second string a little bit. And then the high strings, I think I detuned one. Who knows what the tuning was?
Right.
And I went, wow, now it sounds good open. And instantly figured out if I slid my finger up on the lower strings at different places, I could instantly make what sounded like bar chords.
Yeah.
With the ringing part open.
Right.
So this is the first hour. So at the end of the first hour, I was like, oh, great. And I wrote a song.
No words.
No words right away. There's a little boombox cassette somewhere of it. I have like in a big thing of all my cassettes where I'm just basically going like, oh, wow, I can do this. And so I just wrote a song. I don't remember what it was called. I don't remember the contents because as soon as I was done with that one, I wrote another one right away. In my mind, I was like, I sound just, this is like, oh my God, I basically sound, you know, like J.K. Lee right now. But I didn't sound like J.K. Lee at all. I was like, yeah, I'm George Lynch. This is amazing. And, you know, like, and so that's the beginning. Like, and it just was like that every day. And
with no guidance?
No, man. There was nobody to tell me anything.
But how do you learn how to play guitar?
That's it. I just tuned it down. And then I just started to figure out the low, like, I figured out kind of how that stuff would work.
Yeah.
And then I would also figure out later, quickly, I was like, okay, what combinations work? And luckily, some of the middle strings were still in regular tuning. So a normal bar chord seemed obvious to me, also from pictures.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, I was like, it doesn't, I was like, I'll try it on the lower ones, but if this is the tuning everyone's using, they sound weird here, but it's cool. And later on, I would find out that like you could kind of do like dun 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 by just moving that one.
Yeah.
But in the middle, I would slide up with the drone.
Yeah.
It all kind of ended up sounding a little bit like, I don't know, like by the time I met and played with the first musician, which was not long after that, it probably sounded like surf rock and Sonic Youth mixed a little bit, like because
you figured out dun, 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 but you had this noise at the other
end. Well, I would never play that, even though I knew what that was. I was mostly trying to get stuff to sound kind of dissonant, like dissonant and cool. Like I remember thinking, like I really want this. Like I loved Husker Du and I loved like Driving and Crying, and I loved like REM, and I loved mostly metal.
Yeah.
But I knew weirdly though I didn't want to play metal, which I don't know how. I don't know how I knew that.
Yeah.
I think something in me went, you stayed up to watch the Cowboy Junkies the other night on SNL. Like
yeah.
You did that.
Yeah.
Like, so like as metal as you are, you that's probably not who you are on the guitar. Your true self comes out on guitar, I think.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
And so and the Cowboy Junkies resonated.
Oh man, big time.
But metal's satisfying to listen to. But maybe it was not where, obviously it wasn't where your heart was going to express itself.
I mean, I make a lot of it at Soundcheck, and I definitely do it in my own studio tons. And it's fun, and I can see the complexities of had I committed to it, I think I would have eventually broke through, and it would have had a lot of parts of breakdowns of clean arpeggiations into heavy riffs.
Yeah.
But it doesn't stick with me the same way as like maybe trying to sort of like trying to stumble onto a song. I sort of heard it echoing from far away, and I called it through the guitar and like the and let it kind of become a thing.
And that's how you write?
I think it's a little bit like it's not automatic writing, but it's a form of it. Like I mostly write by I'll wait until I have a couple of friends around, like a bass player, drummer, and
yeah.
I'll just, in the moment, like play some chords that feel expressive to me. I mean, the new record, Prisoner, is just me and my best friend, Johnny T, in New York, because I couldn't be here for a while. I mean, I could be here for a while, but I didn't want to be here for a minute.
Why?
Like, I was going through a divorce. Like, it takes a minute. It's just life. It's not a big deal.
Recently?
Yeah, I mean, to go make new music, I wanted to go back to New York where I had lived before, and before I lived in LA, and be with my best friend and be at a studio, just so I didn't, just driving down Sunset was weird.
So how do you move from, you know, these open tunings, you know, half Sonic Youth, half surf, into what was the experience with Cowboy Junkies? That sounds like it was a cathartic sort of moment. There was a window there.
Yeah. I mean, I remember seeing the Sweet Jane video and being mystified.
Well, that's a great song.
Yeah. I mean, I knew it was a Velvet Underground song.
Yeah.
But what they were doing at that time, there was a couple of bands that really interested me, specifically Galaxy 500.
Yeah.
I was waiting for On Fire to come out. It was one of the big records of my life. And I believe the same issue or somewhere around the same time, Galaxy 500 On Fire was getting a great review at the same time that there was a Daydream Nation Sonic Youth review in the Rolling Stone. And I was like, oh my gosh, there's like two huge records coming out that I want.
Yeah.
So once I heard Galaxy 500 and they were so slow and so mesmerizing, it was easy for me to sort of, from Cowboy Junkies to Galaxy 500, there was something about that idea of like music that's slow is really calling me, but music that's slow and it sort of feels effortless and there's like this stuff passing me by, it just really made sense.
Yeah.
And I loved Sonic Youth's Sister, which also was a very weird record. And strangely enough, when I went to the record bar in the mall, which I used to skate to, like I skateboarded to go get the first Danzig solo record the day it came out, I was so stoked, you know, like I was used to smell the cassette, I'm like, oh, I could smell it's like fresh, it just came off the printer, like an idiot, you know. And like, and it was a pretty far away place to skate to get a cassette, but those days really were beautiful because I was sort of fetishizing records and getting a record and then examining all the things that it were in there.
Yeah.
So by the time actually that I'd had a couple of songs on this tuning, I go to the record store, and for some reason you're different. You've played guitar, or I was.
Yeah.
And I noticed that the guy, one of the guys behind the desk, and then this other guy that worked there that looked kind of like he could have been in Social Distortion, but if they were clearly from North Carolina, if you could put that in your mind.
Yeah.
I was like, these guys are like looking at me in a funny way. And I guess I was always asking questions about the SST records, if they had certain records. And there might have been an ad up that said, like, there is a show in town and that they were looking for other musicians. And he was like, yeah. He's like, I see you're always looking at the Sonic Youth stuff, and you buy like some cool stuff here. And I was like, right on.
Yeah.
And he's like, he was like, do you play music? And I was like, well, I was like, yeah, I play guitar. He's like, you play guitar? I was like, yeah, I play guitar. And he's like, well, what's the vibe? And I said, I don't know. Like, I think it sounds like Dokken and Sonic Youth a little bit or something.
Yeah.
I made some reference that was completely off base.
Yeah.
And I remember he was like, right away, he was like, man, we need to jam. He was like, what are you doing later? And I'm like, what, you mean like today? He's like, yeah. I was like, I don't know. Like, I think I'm going, I don't remember what the thing was, but he was like, cool. Well, tomorrow I have this friend that plays drums. You meet up at it, like, I can meet you at like 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
And we'll go jam.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, cool. And I told him the street corner to meet me at. And like, I went there with the guitar. I got in the van. We drove out to this rehearsal place. And then the drummer guy, it was really cool looking. They had microphones and a PA and a 4-track and this big ass drum set. And sure enough, the guy that walks in, that's the drummer.
Yeah.
His name is Alan Midget, and he was the guy who lived behind my grandmother's house that had a half pipe that I could never skate, that I grew up hearing punk rock coming out of a boombox from. And like, I wanted them to skate because I loved watching them skate from an early age. So I would even go over and try to sweep the ramp thinking it would summon them. And he'd be like, get out of my yard, brat. And I used to play like touch football. Like, I mean, we call it touch football, but it was like the cruelest, harshest form of football ever with no helmets, like out in the court, this like cul-de-sac and in front of my grandma's house. And I couldn't believe that it was that guy. Like, is this guy new since I could remember? And he at this point was like, had dreadlocks, and he was working at like a surf shop, and and he came in and he was like, what are you doing here, geek? And I was like, oh man. And I showed him the song, and I think he realized right away, I was like, so this is what I have. I could tell right away that he didn't want to tell me that the guitar was not in a standard tuning.
Yeah, because he thought you knew something.
He didn't tell me for a long time, which is really weird. But I could tell that he was marking to know kind of where notes were.
Yeah.
Because he'd be like, here, just tune it all up so it sounds good with this note. It would be like his G or D.
He's trying to get you to tune your guitar.
But yeah, basically, but keep the tuning the way it was.
Right.
So, but I showed him the first song. He was like, no way. And we started playing it right away. And as we're jamming it, I remember like right in the middle of the jam, and I don't know if I was mumbling some words into the PA, but mostly it was just instrumental, but it sounded so cool. Like the chorus was cool. And I went into this improv part. I was so into it. I was like, high up on the thing. But right before that moment, it's the first note I ever recorded really with the band, is he must have been like, oh shit. And he like reaches over, lunges over, and hits record on the 4-track.
Yeah.
And he gets that moment on tape, the whole session. And I have that tape. And you can hear the thing go, and then the riff, like the whole first riff. So like, I have my first moment with these guys who would be like my best friends and my heroes and like my, you know, your first thing.
Yeah.
It's on a cassette. It's so cool. And it sounds still incredible. It sounds like the energy is so insane.
Well, it's all like, it's on fire. It's your first time playing with people.
Yeah. And they really responded, I think, because I think a lot of the stuff that they a lot of the guitar players they were finding, I think, were probably either really metal but didn't have a lot of their own ideas,
right,
or wanted to just do covers.
And also there's that time where you don't know enough to be cynical or doubting. Like, you're just in it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's eventually what you always try to get back to, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like, you only knew these four things, so you were going to get everything you could get out of them once the vibe kicked in.
True. Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny. I think I've stayed in that place for a long time.
How long did you play with those guys?
Over a year.
Yeah.
I mean, we played until we couldn't play anymore. Alan and I became very tight. He stayed my friend his whole life, and he went through a lot of stuff before he died, which wasn't just only a couple years ago, around the time that I was going through the first stages of a divorce and stuff. Alan passed away. It was brutal, very brutal. But yeah, he always, it's funny, he kind of loved the Cowboy Junkies, and he loved the idea of playing mellower stuff as well. That's kind of how our first band split into two, and that's when I think I started to go like, okay, cool, what are songs?
Right. And how do you land on the band Whiskey Town? How do you land on going back to that, the sort of American roots music?
Well, I moved to Raleigh eventually from Jacksonville.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't stay there anymore. I had sort of outgrown it. And before I had moved, I started a band with my friend Kevin Doddridge, who taught me how to play a regular tuned guitar.
Yeah.
Because I used to be like, God, I have to stretch my fingers like as far as I'll go to hit this chord. And he'll go, and he was the first guy to go, Ryan, you know that that's just a G chord. I'm like, what are you talking about?
You're like Bubble Boy.
I guess so. And I remember going like, why did nobody tell me this? And they're like, because it sounded cool. Like, who's to say that that's right anyway? It could change any day. Like, we were so isolated. They're like, it could change. Like, that could become what people do later. And yeah. Like, that's not real. Like, come on. Like, I don't know. Like, I'm pretty sure like G and C and D are established. Yeah. It's going to stay there. There's books that talk about it. And I was like, wow, like D chords feel so cool.
Yeah.
I moved to Raleigh. I got two jobs. I couldn't really find a decent job.
Yeah.
Which was hard. I lived in like kind of like a sort of one room temporary kind of, I don't know what people would call it now. Like, I mean, there were definitely people there that were probably like, I don't know, like doing a lot of drugs and yeah. stuff. And I was walking down the street.
Yeah.
And this guy named Skillet Gilmore.
Yeah.
He goes, hey, man, I heard you're looking to start a new band. Maybe it sounds like some Cowboy Junkie stuff. And I was like, how do you know? And he goes, I don't know. People talk. It's weird. And he's like, come inside for a beer. Yeah. And I did. And I told him, I was like, well, I might have to leave town because I'm out of money. I don't have a job, but I really want to do it. And he's like, I'll give you a job where you could work here. And he had just taken over running that place.
Yeah.
And he was a drummer and he was really cool. And I said, yes. And like I ended up, you know, we ended up right away like finding different people to be in the band like straight out of the bat.
Yeah.
I think by that night we basically had most of the lineup just from speculation.
Yeah. They were all around?
Yeah. There were people that someone else knew or like, well, I know this person that plays violin that could play some fiddle who sings. She's really good.
And, yeah.
And they're like, oh, what about Steve? Steve could play bass. And like I was like, wow, this is happening very fast. And by the end of the evening, like we were all pretty loaded.
Yeah.
But we had basically kind of more or less formulated what we were going to do.
And then you started working, playing.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't really play with some of those principal characters until a bit later on. And originally, Skillet, myself, and this other guy named Brian, we kind of tried a three-piece for a minute that kind of sounded like the Gun Club while we were sort of still trying to set up stuff with the band. But I remember the first time all five of us ever played, and it was actually really good.
Yeah.
Like, we just kind of, like, we just sort of, we thought, we played, like, what we thought was a country song, and I knew it didn't sound like that.
Yeah.
And mutually, I think we all kind of looked around and were like, wow, this is accidentally kind of works.
Right.
In a sort of shitty, we don't have a bridge kind of way.
Uh-huh. And that was the beginning of the sound.
that definitely, I mean, it never variated. It always stayed kind of crappy.
Yeah.
What can we do with this?
Yeah. You know,
which
right.
is, which is pretty cool.
Throughout the entire career of Whiskey Town?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the only difference would be by the time we made that second record, Jim Scott really tried to find a bigger sound in us, and he did, but it wasn't something that we could reproduce live.
Right.
And then the third record with Ethan Johns was so experimental that it was only Caitlin and I left that it really was just like a soft transition into being solo.
What happens after Whiskey Town? You build a pretty good following with Whiskey Town, right?
No. I think history is wrong about Whiskey Town. In fact, most of what happened at Whiskey Town and even the tours and stuff, they were pretty terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, they were
like replacements terrible?
No. I mean, I've read that book, and but they were really truly talented.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that I have no talent.
Right.
But I'm saying that I cannot imagine having that degree of talent.
Right.
That band, let alone just Tommy and Paul have.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. And but for me, that band for me, like being in Whiskey Town felt like, okay, cool, we started kind of this country thing, we kind of went there and it makes sense, but we never could really, like, I wasn't really applying myself and didn't understand how songcraft worked completely, although I was beginning to,
right?
And there are certainly some really cool things on the first record that I thought, ooh, I'm breaking through, I'm understanding. I used to spend a lot. It's the first time I would spend time, like I'd go get like a cheap bottle of whiskey and like a couple of beers, go back to my like one room, you know, like place, like right, you know, like on the main drag in Raleigh, and listen to records and go, wow, what happens in this bridge? Like, here's this bridge. Like, and I would sort of just smoke cigarettes and think about how it all, like how songs worked.
Yeah.
So it was just that's how that stuff happened. But knowing how to play live and being comfortable and playing gigs, like, I mean, some of those shows were the worst things that could have ever been, but they weren't glamorously bad. They were like, look over and like Caitlin in my band is crying. And I'm unaware of totally fucked up I am, and maybe someone else in the band is, and I'm like, wow, like, did we just play that song in like 30 seconds? And I'll go like, maybe we just ended that song after a verse, I thought it was over. And like, and like after a couple of times of that, you just see someone crying, you're like, wow, this is terrible. Someone on stage, like the music is making them cry and they're not moved. Like stuff like that. I mean I was very young. I mean, it's the same age that anybody would be when they're staying up all night in college and partying and whatever.
Once that fizzles out and you start to work solo, what changed?
You know, it's a very interesting thing. Whiskey Town was still together when I moved to New York City the first time. And I only left for a minute, just long enough to get stuff together and to go back. But I lived in New York City, and I lived with my girlfriend, and we had a couple of black cats, and like things were great. And she worked in the music industry, and I was sort of waiting to see what would happen with my band, because we had done the Stranger's Almanac tour stuff, and I was still kind of waiting, like, okay, like, when is this next record that I had done in Woodstock with Ethan going to come out, and are we going to tour?
That was the odd record with just you and Caitlin mostly?
Yeah, it was a record called Pneumonia.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a not great album title. But I mean, like, I don't know. I remember she came home one day and she said, this thing is happening with the music industry and it's really bad. I was like, what do you mean? She's like, well, this company is going to buy a lot of the other companies, and I think everybody's going to be affected, and maybe even my job. She's like, you should find out about what's happening with yours. I'm like, no, it'll never happen. I'm fine. Sure enough, it basically put my album and Outpost Records, it put it into a freeze where I couldn't leave, but I couldn't release that record, and I didn't know what to do.
Pneumonia.
Yeah. And so, you know, what really sucks is, living in New York City and being younger and the pressure of like, how do we pay the rent? And like, how do we get to the next step? And like, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
It was really hardcore. It was the first time I ever felt that pressure as an adult to go like, oh my God, like my job is play music. And now I'm actually going to, I have to figure out a way to provide.
Yeah.
So
for yourself.
Yeah. And I couldn't, there wasn't, I mean, no matter what, my friend Jesse Mallon at the time was like, come down to Niagara and you could just DJ for a couple hours. They'll give you some money. But I realized at some point they were just being nice. They knew it was falling apart for me.
Yeah. Were you using drugs?
No, I mean, occasionally, yeah. but I wasn't, at that point, like I would do some if they were around, but right. I wasn't holding.
Yeah.
We would drink a lot, but usually for free. We knew somebody that was a bartender,
right, sure.
at some bar. You know how it is.
Yeah.
And so somebody's got a little bit of blow or something, you do sure. a little bit, but I wasn't like rolling, you know?
Yeah.
But I think what led to Heartbreaker was the very humbling thing was, Amy and I, are very much connected. Well, we always will be. And to this day, we still are. But we just had a kinship and a vibe and a mutual sort of dream. And the financial aspect of like what happened with that, I guess it was Seagram's bought Geffen or whatever they did, or however, whatever that thing that changed yeah. around the late 90s happened, that really, it broke my heart. It broke her heart. It broke us a little bit. She's from Jersey, so she was going to move back for a minute to figure her stuff out. And I didn't have anywhere to go. So I had to call someone that I knew in Raleigh, North Carolina. And of course, my next step was to call Alan and say like, man, like it's falling apart up here. I'm coming back.
Yeah.
And most people are like, he'll never move back to Jacksonville. And fuck if I didn't. I like a friend picked me up and I remember the last day in the apartment and I left the stuff that I couldn't take with me. And I took some stuff with me and we got in the van and we headed south. And I remember seeing the city get smaller and smaller out the back window.
Yeah.
And man, that was, I can think of that moment right now. It was so brutal. It was like,
a failure moment.
Oh man. For me, it was like, that's it. That was my time. That was my time as a musician.
Right.
I was like, I'm going to probably go back into the construction business because I was a great plumber. Like
yeah.
building new plumbing was, I'm very good at it. And roofing, I was always good at roofing.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be good now. I would get dizzy and kill myself on accident. But, you know, when I was younger, I was always fine to be out in the cold and cold doesn't bother me.
Were you working for your dad?
No, but my dad taught me the trades
yeah.
a little bit when he could so that I could go get a job for anybody. And he would always know a contact or something that I could go get on some crew. And
yeah, yeah.
It would always be pretty hardcore. I mean, it wouldn't be like me and some other punks. It was yeah. like me and some like grizzled dudes that like crawled out of like some, I don't know where.
Yeah.
Like, but you know, it was a living. It was fine. And I thought I was done.
Yeah.
I got back to North Carolina and you know, it was pretty kind of, it was a really long, sad, weird time. Like I was sleeping on couches for a minute, partying because I was back in town. People were happy to see me,
yeah.
but inside me I was like, I failed. Like,
yeah.
I failed. I'm not in a band anymore.
Yeah.
I'm nobody. And then so I couldn't deal with that feeling. So I left from there and went back further east to Jacksonville and moved back in with my friend Alan, like, which was pretty amazing.
The drummer.
Yeah. I now lived in the house that's backyard fence linked up to my grandmother's backyard fence. I was on the other side of the fence now.
But your grandparents were still there?
My grandmother was still yeah. alive, but my grandfather died.
Yeah.
He died and I left home.
Right.
It's like I was there till he passed.
Right.
And when he passed about the same time that my cat Bully was poisoned, I'm relatively sure. And I remember thinking like, I'm out.
Yeah.
So this was kind of a return. In fact, I didn't tell anyone that I had gotten back.
Yeah.
I didn't want anyone to know.
Yeah.
And that's where I wrote Heartbreaker, in his living room.
Yeah.
I went to Nashville. It was very weird. It was just me and Ethan and an engineer in the studio. And that was how Heartbreaker started.
Yeah.
And Gillian and Dave would come around.
Gillian Welch?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Dave Rollins. They came around, I think, like two different nights to sort of see what we were up,
right.
Like what was going on. And Emmy came down, and I had been around her before. And
Emmy Lou Harris? Where had you been around her?
I first met her at this show that's no longer on the air that's called Sessions at West 54.
Yeah.
And they did a special about the music of Graham Parsons.
Right.
And they had different people playing with the house band. And she and I had met at that. I think we actually maybe met before that at Black Mountain Bluegrass Festival or something. Yeah. And then so I saw her there.
When you were with Whiskey Town?
Yes, but I used to do a more broken down version of it.
Right. And you were a Graham Parsons fan?
Yes. I was obsessed with, like, when I first heard Graham Parsons, it took me a long time to process that he existed.
Was it after the Cowboy Junkies?
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the first things that Skillet did was, you know, he like gave me a beer and we talked and he put on the, Graham Parsons, he put on GP.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the fuck is this? He's like, wait, you don't know what this is? I was like, no, what is this? And he showed me the CD cover.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, who is this person?
Yeah.
He's like, oh man. He's like, we have a lot to talk about. He's like, do you know the Flying Burrito Brothers? And I'm like, you're making that name up for sure. And he's like, man, he's like, yeah. You got to come by the house and we should just listen to records. And so he kind of showed me like, look, people have gone here before, but they didn't even know what they were doing.
Either. Right.
And he was putting it to me in the way that he and I used to talk. He'd be like, man, like these were like hippies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, what are they doing making country music? What happened? He's like, I don't know. Like, we'd be all wasted. He's like, I don't know. He's like, maybe they were confused about what it was.
So you got to get hip to the Birds, to the Flying Burrito Brothers, to the band.
Sweethearts of the Rodeo happened. Yeah. I remember like, what?
Yeah.
And the band at first I didn't like.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because I didn't like Big Star at first either. But then it's that thing that like, oh, I hope it still happens with people now. But it's when you're washing dishes at a restaurant, because that's your job,
yeah.
And different people get a chance to put in what cassette they want, yeah. They make a mixtape.
Right.
A song might come on, and you might not like it at first, or you might not know the band, but it's a particular song,
yeah.
And it's like, For You by Big Star.
Yeah.
I remember washing dishes and stopping cold, and I'm like, whoa, what is this? And I was like, this is exactly how I feel. And I ran in, and the like Brian Walsby was the second cook in Raleigh, and I was like, what is this song? He's like, man, we're slammed. What are you doing? He's like, they need dishes. And I'm like, what is this song? And he's like, it's Big Star. He's like, you hate him. I'm like, no, I don't hate him anymore. And he stops for a second. And he goes, really? And I'm like, aren't you slammed? He's like, we'll talk about it later. And I'm like, so the whole rest of the night, I'm like, play the cassette again. Like that whole kind of thing happened.
Yeah.
Well, so later on that happened with me with the band, like the Brown album was the record where I was
the
like,
the second record with them on cover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, wow. Like that record still to this day, I'm like, what is going on? Like there definitely was something to my discovery of that stuff, because being from Eastern North Carolina, you're subjected to country music, and even at that time, I don't remember George Strait at all, but I definitely heard Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
I knew Hank Williams. My grandfather loved all that, and my grandmother, you know, if there was like the Mandrills, like a TV special on, we watched it. Hee Haw,
yeah,
Loretta Lynn, big deal in my house.
Yeah.
So, but to get hip to Graham was different. I think that changed the game dramatically for me. In fact, that had to have been the first time I went, like where I saw someone writing a song and I went, this is a mystical thing. This isn't, it's very different than my punk rock and post-punk records. This is I knew they were referencing, it's like I used to say, like, they're like messing with like real music.
Right.
I was like, they're doing something with real music, but it's like just on the line.
Yeah.
It was my only way of describing it.
Yeah. But you saw that Graham showed you that songwriting could be something transcendent in and of itself?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I'd ever really... I mean, it's interesting to say that when I first started listening to that and I was in Whiskey Town, it didn't affect me and reach me, although it was kind of doing it the way that it was like sort of like a seed.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is you have to fast forward to when that band breaks up, but it breaks up weirdly when I'm in New York.
Yeah.
And I have to leave to go back. And then I get back to Jacksonville, where I just basically wrote songs and didn't know what was going to happen to my life. And I just went, you know what, this would be cool. I make little records.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll make records and do some club dates once in a while, and I'll have a regular job. That's what I thought was going to happen. But like, I could listen to those records by that time finally and do that thing where you make a couple of neat glasses of whiskey and have a beer and
yeah.
smoke cigarettes and like you cry like as a man, like as a young man, but still like because of your life, like you let the song hit you. It's just you and the record.
Yeah.
You're by yourself in the house and like your liberal tears go down your face and you're like, wow, like this song is killing me and like raising me up from the dead at the same time. That fucking feeling that you get. You know, for most people, I think that probably hasn't happened until they listen to like Bonnie Raitt, like, I Can't Make You Love Me If You Won't. Like that vibe. You know what I mean? Like, some songs are going to do it to you whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
Like, they really hit you. But for me, I processed that information in an unusual way that I think kind of mixed it with how much I loved Dylan and how much I loved, you know, I just loved early Bob Dylan so much. Like, I just loved that sound and the connection there. And
then, so you go back and you end up in Nashville playing with these amazing musicians.
Yeah.
And you make your first solo record.
Yeah, and I was just there to make the record. I didn't really think I would stay, but I got there and my manager was smart enough to be like, well, listen, I basically rented you a house.
Yeah.
So, because I think you should stay here. And I was like, oh, really?
Well, he believed in you.
Yeah, I think he wanted to get me out of, like, I think he knew that I was on that line of going, like, I'm done. Like, I'm just going to go move back home.
And, right.
Which would have been really interesting if I'd have done that.
So, after Heartbreaker, you must have built some confidence.
I mean, more than I had
before. And when you made Gold, what was the plan? What was your manager telling you to do? What were you doing?
Well, so I did the Heartbreaker tour by myself.
Yeah.
And
just you and a guitar?
Yeah, and then a tour manager, my friend Van.
Yeah.
And who wasn't really a tour manager, he just figured it out to do it.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I really went to England. It was the first time I really toured other countries where I really played solo by myself and really kind of played some regal places.
Yeah.
I didn't even know it was in magazines. Someone had to tell me.
Yeah.
They're like, you're in this magazine called Mojo.
I'm oh, like, yeah. I remember Mojo.
And I'm like, what is that? And so I did all that and I came back and my manager set up a deal for me to move from Bloodshot to a label called Lost Highway, but it was essentially Mercury Records, which I was afraid to be on anyway. And but I did it because he was like, look, it's going to be great. They told me all the stuff that they tell anyone. Like, we'll let you do whatever you want.
Yeah.
So I did that. And then I went to record the follow-up, which was actually a double album. But it was that many songs. But it was just me and a guitar.
Yeah.
And Bob Dylan's slide guitar player.
Yeah.
And sometimes a stand-up bass player.
Yeah.
And I wanted it that stripped back
because
that's what I learned on the road. I was like, wow, that the root of the song is great. The song's great.
Right.
So I did all these recordings and they liked some of them. They didn't love them. And that later on got in the early days of CDs and then laptops happened. That eventually got bootlegged to become this thing called, people call it the Suicide Handbook. That's what they call this bootleg.
Yeah.
But the original thing I wrote on the disc that they must all be from was the Career Suicide Handbook.
Oh, okay.
Because someone told me when I played it for them, if that was my record, they're like, well, this is just Career Suicide. And I was like, that's a great name for the record. And
they're
like, you can't call it that. And I'm like, okay, so basically everything you said is not true.
Yeah.
It's like, you're like, you could do whatever you want. Like, you just want to support the artist, but no, you can't call your record that, and it's not this record.
Right.
So I was like, well, cool. I talked to Ethan. He goes, come out to LA and let's just make stuff. There's some cool, he's like, you got some cool songs left over from Heartbreaker. You have some of these new ones. Let's just like call in some people like we did last time and see what happens. And I kind of was like blown away by the sunshine and blown away by meeting people. Yeah. And I didn't know Heartbreaker had reached people that at the time I never would have met.
Right.
So I was around for the first time people that I was akin to, but they were people that live here. And it's hard if you don't live in Hollywood to realize, like, you can literally be at a diner somewhere and you're a spastic arty person and you could be from Arkansas.
Yeah.
And like, maybe you didn't think anyone was like you, but a couple of your freaky friends.
Yeah.
And you have all these touchstones in pop culture, but like, you could be at just a deli or something. Yeah. And like, you could meet like, you know, Ali Sheedy.
Yeah.
Like, or something like,
right.
Like, and like, you could have like this wicked conversation because it's, because you both love the band X. It just happens. And then you could say, okay, later, like, that's just how it is.
Yeah.
And or you could run into like Ray Manzarek, like,
right.
when he was alive. I did that several times and I was like, I was like, wow, there's Ray Manzarek.
Yeah,
and
I he's still like, get that. Yeah.
He was totally cool. And yeah. like, I think, and I, so I think for that influenced the record and I felt optimistic and I was on the other side of a pretty deep wound. My career wasn't gone. I was making an album.
So, a lot of people were on that album, on Gold.
Yeah, Ethan lived here at the time, so he knew a lot of musicians who were great. Ben Mont, who later was someone that I played with on my last couple of records. And
he's great. I talked to him. Ben Mont Tench. Yeah.
Yeah, he's amazing and amazing friend. But he played on that record, and I never even met him then.
Kamasi Washington, too, it says.
Yeah, I was there for that session. But Ben Mont came in and played and was gone before I got there.
And Chris Stills is a friend of yours.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he...
his dad, Steven Stills.
Yeah. And then strangely, again, what's interesting is
yeah.
Ethan and Chris were down the hall making right. their record with the Stones were across the hall. And I was just in that side room
yeah.
at... it's called... I think it's called Cello now, or maybe they change it back to East West or whatever the studio's name yeah. at the time was. But so that's the same place where Liz Phair, Whiskey Town...
Yeah.
Rolling Stones and Chris Stills all in the same building. It goes back to like there's that first connection happening again and then with the second person.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
So Gold does well for you. That's did you chart?
I don't think I did. I don't remember if it did. I think they spent a lot of money and a lot of time
yeah.
On promo for that record.
Yeah.
And I remember I never stopped doing promo. And like it was sort of a, like any person that would be up for it, I talked to them. It was that sort of time in my career.
Yeah.
So I feel like what people felt that record was versus what it did were different. Also, that was a different time. That was some of the earliest days when you could start bootlegging records.
Right.
Which I didn't know about.
Yeah.
Which is fine. Also, this other thing happened, 9/11 happened. And,
yeah.
And that actually happened the day my record came out, which is pretty wild.
Hmm.
I think that was the day that the Strokes, Is This It came out on that day. I remember it like this.
Yeah.
I still was playing shows and I still was in my zone. Like I played a show only a couple months later and like Elton came out and played on stage with me at like Irving Plaza, which was so cool of him. And it was super amazing. Elton John came out to play and like things like that would happen all the time. But you know, mostly, as I remember it, even though these cool things could be happening, my focus and no one else's focus, especially living in New York, was really ever far away from the shock of that. Like it really resonated. And I don't remember, I wasn't taking a lot of drugs or doing anything too crazy. I just, that time I think was mostly like, you just wake up and go like, I got to get through today. Like, you yeah. know, and I'm not going to look at the television and then you do. And then like, you're mortified again and people were scared.
Yeah, I was there. It was horrible.
Really horrible. And so people go like, so yeah, like after 9/11, like your song became like an anthem of sorts. I'm like, no, man, like it didn't.
Which one? New York, New York?
Yeah, but people say that, but I go yeah. like, that's not true.
Yeah.
Like I remember the radio at that time, like they played like John Lennon. They played Neil Young. Like
yeah.
radio changed that yeah. for a while.
Yeah.
It took a minute for anybody. It was kind of bizarre that like it's like all of a sudden people went towards the most meaning possible and the things that they cherished. And it was like it's a very sobering thing, but radio changed, TV changed, you know?
Yeah.
It's hard to watch David Letterman and Conan O'Brien at that time, like, crying on TV and like really breaking down. I mean, but that's how everybody felt.
It's horrible.
Months later, you're walking around and you could still like
smell it.
Smell that soot in the air.
That weird metal, that melting metal smell.
You could taste it. Yeah. I remember I was like, it was a pretty bizarre. So yeah, I didn't have that experience of going, of being able to feel that record.
So you got through that. Well, what caused you to get, like you say, you still get high. What caused you to get, you know, sober off? What are you off of, booze?
Yeah, I don't. Well, I mean, some people would say like pot is a drug, but, and I get it, but it's, you know, I did a.
It's not coke. It's not dope. It's not booze.
And I did a very, very long time where I was just totally straight.
Yeah.
But I could not find any way without. I couldn't find a way to deal with Meniere's disease without the suggestion that I should take stuff for the pain. And
what is the symptoms of that exactly?
It's very hard to describe, but I'll sort of put it this way. Like if you're sitting in a chair and it's normal and you're talking to someone and then I have what I feel like is an episode and I get up, especially if I have been stressed or sometimes it's triggered. It could be haven't been sleeping well and I get like a bulb flashes or something flashes really quickly.
Yeah.
Then it's like the distance from where my feet are to the ground. I don't know how far it is to the ground.
What?
It's
That's
like
crazy.
It's like, it feels like you're on the edge of a building, but then also like, so your stomach drops and it feels like you're sick.
Yeah.
And then you can't really eat. You can, but you just get really sick. And my jaw goes numb, and then my hands go numb. It used to be much worse, and I just would be in bed because I just couldn't.
Yeah.
I couldn't be.
Weed helps.
It's really funny. Like I was just dealing with it, and I was just shipwrecked for years, and I quit playing music. I quit playing live because I couldn't handle it. Like nothing worked. And one day, my brother-in-law was like, he's like a funny and cool dude. But he was like, hey man, I hate to know that you're sick, but so I made these cookies. Like, I know you don't really, you know, do anything.
But yeah.
I saw these cookies and make you feel better. They're really mellow. And I was like, what is he talking about? And I didn't really think about it. I just went, ooh, cookie.
Yeah.
So I ate like half a cookie.
Yeah.
And instantly, in the middle of this drawn out, really horrible time, not feeling good, I felt better. Like, in a couple of hours, I don't know, I just felt better.
Yeah.
And by that night, I went for a walk, and like I had like a little bit more of an appetite, and I just was like, this is working. I was like, I'm not like, ooh, let me see how many cookies I can eat. Like, I didn't go right into some kind of place. But when I was diagnosed, they were like, you need to stop smoking.
Yeah.
You cannot drink.
Yeah.
They're like, you cannot drink coffee. You cannot have sodium. Like, the guy basically explained it to me. He was like, you're going to have to eventually find a way to get exercise when you can and change all this stuff in your life or it'll exacerbate it.
Because
he was like, it's a degenerative disease and the longer you have it, the worse that you will get. And he's like, the usual finality of what happens is you go deaf. I was like, wow, this is a game changer.
Yeah.
So I just live with that for, that's kind of why I was like, I gotta stop touring with the Cardinals. We were so loud.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like it was when it started. And so I went off the road and I just, because I lived here for a while, I went to like see an acupuncturist. I'd never done that. It helped. I went to see a hypnotherapist to deal with attacks. Like, what do I do when I have an attack? If I'm like on stage, or like, what would be the theoretical thing?
Yeah.
And to quit smoking. And,
yeah.
That worked, and little by little, I started to get better. It was like it's like a pathetic version of Rocky. It's just like a dude trying to figure out how to get back to guitar.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're better. Why did you do a whole why did you cover Taylor Swift's record?
Why?
Yeah. What compelled you?
I don't know. I guess it's one of those things like have you ever done something creative and you finish it because you started it?
Yeah.
Because it's like it'll be hard, but it's like, that would be really hard. I should try that. And then you get halfway or whatever, and you're like,
what am I doing?
Or maybe you ask yourself that, but you go like, I got to finish it. I started it now.
Yeah.
And then you finish it and you're stoked that you did. You went, that's so cool. I did it.
My version of 1989.
Yeah, man. I want to hear your version of it. Here's the interesting thing.
Yeah.
I learned a ton from doing that.
Yeah.
And I needed to be playing, and I wasn't on tour.
Yeah.
And I would have gone crazy had I not been.
Yeah.
And I just like, but I also was like, I didn't want to write more songs.
Right. And you liked your songs?
Yes. I think that there are some of her songs that it's just crystalline.
So what'd you learn?
Well, because that record was different and it wasn't like her on a guitar.
Yeah.
That's the other weird thing is it was like, wow, like how do I process this record?
Yeah.
You know, she's my friend. Like we don't like go to football games and chill together or anything. But like, you know, we check in and talk about music once in a while. And she's always been, supports my vibe and vice versa. But I knew that I was like, it was even if I hadn't known her, I wanted to do it because I was like, well, I'm not going to do like, I don't want to cover like Dark Side of the Moon or something.
Right, right.
I wanted to know what that record was.
Yeah.
And when I was on tour, I would listen to it and go like, well, I'm like, wow, this is really beat oriented. But so where I can hear the bass line and it's cool because you're using a sub bass. And then there's this top line. I'm like, so where is it on the guitar?
Yeah.
In my mind, I was imagining the capo positions.
Right.
So by the time I just sat down with me and my buddy Todd, that we'd go on the quest to make anything sound like the Smiths. Like our thing was, what if we try to make that record feel like the Smiths or something?
Yeah.
And I was like, it should be like that. But if we can't make it like that, then we just try to make it sound like Darkness on the Edge of Town. He was like, we're in. Let's do this. And we got a couple in and we're like, it really works.
Yeah.
But then came the thing where you go, oh, wow. So, okay, she has all this full range as a vocalist, but I don't. So if I want to play the same chords but make the song work, the only way is capo fourth fret. And I'm going to have to, when I hit this place, like shift. So it was so cool because I'm like, this is way out of my comfort zone. I'm so down for that.
Oh, good.
So by the time I figured it all out and could get my way in, I not only had spent this great time being a musician and just like translating stuff, but I got to think about these tunes in a different way. It felt good. It felt like...
Sure, get some new muscles.
I've never covered a whole record, and the covers that I have done have usually been pretty easy, or they've been to do them.
Yeah.
But it led me to also know that since I didn't start playing guitar doing covers, I made up for it by later covering, like at the time, like the most successful record.
Yeah.
Because that's it's sort of like, you know, most people learn Stairway to Heaven first. Yeah. But for me, I waited until I was like 41 or something, and I covered in 1989.
Love it. One of the reasons I knew I had to talk to you, because you know we've sort of circled around this for a long time, but I don't know. Someone sent me this link of you, not even in a real performance situation, just doing Wharf Rat, the Grateful Dead's Wharf Rat on an acoustic guitar. Somewhere it looked like at a tech show or something. And, you know, like, that is one of my favorite songs of all time.
Me too.
And it just hits me so fucking deeply. And it always has. And I can't even remember the first time I heard it. What is it? Because you developed a relationship with Phil after Jerry died, right? And it was around that song, right?
Yeah. They, I don't know how that happened. I mean, I think it was from, Phil had heard the record I made called Cold Roses.
Yeah.
I think his wife got on that record.
Yeah.
And he it really resonated with him. Uh-huh. And so he started coming to see shows. That song for me, also strangely that you're telling me this, because that song for me was my portal into the Grateful Dead. And I feel like the Grateful Dead is like a geography. It's like if there were a map for it, everybody has a different version of what it is.
Yeah.
But in my mind, like, there are certain places I don't go to.
Yeah.
But I know the neighborhood path to stick to so that I find my way through their catalog and their live stuff. And more and more as I travel it, those places I didn't love before, like, they're actually becoming more familiar and I'm cool with them. But Wharf Rat is on the Skull and Roses, aka Skullfuck record. That record, that song in particular, I don't know what kind of music that is. I don't know what happens, but from the very beginning with this, the toms that are rolling so freely, it's like the African rhythm that just sort of then coalesces into boom, boom, boom. It's like breathing.
Yeah.
It's like yoga. It's like meditation.
Right.
Mysticism.
Yeah.
I feel like when I listen to that song and listen to the Dead, I feel like I can close my eyes and I could feel like the presence of nature, like the actual reality of Earth and like what it sounds like and all the stuff, the noise that we make, it disappears. And I'm like, oh, this is reality.
Yeah.
It's so much more transcendental than you know. Like, there's so many more stories. And they reek of empathy. They reek of compassion. They're not self-victimized and they're not bleeding. Like, they are, it's like a, they're just a fucking huge marshmallow love machine, like a tank made out of marshmallows, just like rolling down a hill of like blueberries. And like, you're just at the bottom and you're like, come on, just hit me. And it just rolls over you and you're like, I'm in. Yeah. And that's to me.
Like, and then you're like, I'll get up and fly away.
Totally. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's an unbelievable thing to say, but the very first time I ever heard that was in North Carolina, and it was early on. It was when I had first moved to the band room with Jerry and Alan, the first guys I played with. And I used to go to Rocky Mount all the time because we had friends there that played guitar. And there was this guy named Dean that was a huge Deadhead. And I was like, I just don't understand. And I'm like, can we? He was like, well, so we'd listen to the Doors. That's how we would, that's how we'd figure it out. One night he's like, I want you to see something.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. And it was Felicia, him, and me. And we drove out into this place that near his dad's farm where there wasn't anything and you could see all the stars and just this really big long stretch of trees. And he's like, I just want you to listen to this. And we were on a little bit of acid.
Yeah.
And he turned up his car stereo and he played that song. And I was like lying down on my back on the hood of the car.
Yeah.
Felicia's lying down the same way. Dean turned it up as loud as it would go. And he had like a Mazda 280Z or something that had like the top came off so you could really hear. And that song came on. And I just remember going like, what? And I'm like looking up, you could see like the Orion constellation. I'm like, what the fuck? And by the time it got to the end, like, I don't think I said anything for hours. Like, I was just like, oh my God. And like, luckily it didn't go into like, you know, it didn't go into like some of the, there's definitely some speed oriented like covers on that record.
Right. Like Elf Johnny Be Good.
Yeah. Which are great. But I just kept that. And I was like, he knew how to get me. He was like, he loves LA Woman. Like, and we listened to early Stones. This is how I'm going to get him in. Yeah. And as soon as he did that, like, what do they say? Like, you're on the bus.
The portal was opened.
Yeah, and I never got to see the Dead. But weirdly, the next time I really ever, I mean, I learned that song, but the fast flash forward to this moment, another one of those moments, like Keith passing me the joint, and it's like the two fingers, like, and it was looking up at Red Rocks and going into the beginning of that song, deciding when it would happen.
Yeah.
And then hearing those bass notes and looking over to my left, and even though I know him and he's my friend,
yeah,
like it's night, there's all these stars, and I'm like, boom, 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 and I hear, and I just, I kept playing, but I just looked to my left, and his fucking, there's Phil, and he just looks at me, and he's smiling. It's like he knows, and I'm just like, I don't know, and I just was like, just get in the song, get in the song. And this, all these people as far as you could see. And I just remember going like, I remember going like, there's no way I'll ever be able to describe what's happening in this moment, but fuck yeah, man.
It just came through you. You decided to go into Wharf Rat and you were playing with Phil and friends, right?
Yeah.
And Phil, as you look over and he's like, yeah.
Totally, man. Totally.
Great talking to you, man.
Nice talking to you.
Beautiful, man. Beautiful. Covered a lot of ground. Interesting dude. Poetic. Interesting mind. And loves the song Wharf Rat. That, you know, no matter what that guy does, I love him for that. Is that all right? Hope you enjoyed that. Go to WTFpod.com/tour to see where I'm going to be playing in the next few months. Maybe I'll be by you. And maybe should I... I'll play a little guitar. Okay. Yeah. You talk me into it.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.